welcome to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm your host, Carol Bruyer. And this evening, we have a special 9/11 Truth Show. We have a couple very interesting guests. Paul Zaremka, who wrote the hidden, or actually edited, the hidden history of 9/11. And in the second hour, Jules Edward, who's organizing the United for Truth March in Belgium on the 7th of September. So with us in the first hour is Paul Zaremka, and I hope that we can get him on the phone. Can you hear me? Paul, are you there yet? I guess we haven't quite got him on the line yet. I know we're going to get him pretty soon. But The Hidden History of 9/11 was published in 2006, and I actually didn't buy a copy of it because it was an academic book that cost over $100, and I found that, even for my ardent activism, a little bit prohibitively expensive. But it has been recently released in a paperback edition by Seven Stories Press. And it's just a really scholarly, academic, critical look at 9/11. And we got him. Paul, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Carol.
Well, congratulations on your work and also for getting a more reasonably priced paperback edition of The Hidden History out so that those of us who can't afford a $100 book can actually buy it and read it. I understand right now you're also on tour and will be coming out to the Bay Area soon. Do you want to just give me an idea of what your tour involves?
Yeah, actually, I haven't actually left yet. I leave on Friday. I go to Seattle, and I have a couple of radio programs, a TV interview, and one talk, and then I go down to the Bay Area. And I'll be with Bob Bowman and when he speaks in Stockton, I guess it's a week from today.
Oh,
and
okay.
Then also I'll be in Sacramento on the 11th, and also in your festival that I think you're one of the principal organizers of in Oakland on September 11th.
Great. And actually, I know you're also invited. We're having a special dinner in Palo Alto on the 7th. So you and Bob and Dick Sado and a number of other activists will be joining me in Palo Alto. But I'm glad that you're coming out this way, and I'm so glad that the book is out in the paperback edition. Now, can you just tell me, too, I know that there's been a great review. I have a link to it from my website. Looking at your book, but why you chose the areas that you chose, and is the book reaching academic circles? Is it what has been your response from the academic community?
Well, okay, first of all, when you ask about why I chose what I chose, you mean why the specific chapters? Is that what you're thinking of?
Well, actually, I know when I organized the San Francisco Inquiry into 9/11, we had a lot of 9/11 truth activists, and we were just trying to figure out what – it's such a huge topic. There's so many different aspects to it. What was our strongest evidence? What were the
– okay.
What were the areas which we could actually, you know, the evidence that was strongest to present to the public to help them become aware of what was going on, the problems with the official story?
Okay. Let me just say that this book was always a joint project. I mean, it was never – I mean, I as editor wasn't calling the big shots, if you know what I mean. It fell into place the way you see it. What happened was that – about 3 years ago, there was a collective of us academics interested in 9/11. They were communicating with each other, not a listserv or anything like that. Just, you know, we just had each other's email addresses. There's maybe about 40 of us. And somebody suggested that we ought to do a book. And to make a long story short, I had the Research in Political Economy Annual, which I had available to be used for such a purpose, and people began to offer what they wanted to contribute to the volume. So some people sort of fit themselves into what was missing from what other people were proposing, and some people straight out had ideas that they definitely wanted to work on. But I think the end result is great, to be frank. I mean, I think it really worked out well, because we don't just do the day of 9/11 itself, but we also look at the background for 9/11 and also the 9/11 Commission report. So I'm quite pleased with the final product. How much, you asked me how much it's getting into the academic community, that's a little bit hard to assess. I mean, it first came out in with a major academic publishing house, Elsevier, out of Amsterdam. That's probably one of the two or three top leading publishers in the academic world. But I would say that academics don't be are scared of getting involved, mostly.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I'm interested because I know Paul Ray and Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips, they're all teaching locally. There's Albert, I can't remember his last name, but they're actually teaching classes about 9/11 here in California in their work. And I know that probably on the East Coast it might be a little different, but one of my nieces wanted to do her senior high school thesis on this topic, and she was discouraged by her professor saying, "No, you don't want to do that because it's too radical, and it would put off some institutions." He really strongly discouraged her from pursuing the topic. So I'm just wondering if anyone's using the book in their classrooms that you're aware of, and how much resistance there is to the information.
I think there must be some people using some of the chapters, because we know from Elsevier allows individual chapters to be downloaded, I mean, for a price. But instead of buying the whole book, you can buy one chapter. And they've had about 1,000 downloads of individual chapters. So probably some of the people are using it for that purpose, but I really can't say that it's been very widespread. And also, I mean, it is a fact that initially the book cost $90 or $95 plus shipping. That would be in our taxes. You know, it's $100 or more to get the book, and that's very discouraging for people. And we knew that. I mean, there was no, but the first thing we really wanted to do is get it out. I mean, get a major publisher to commit to the issue, and they did. Okay, and then the next step was to move it into the mainstream market, what's called the trade market. And the same publisher, Elsevier, was very happy to let a U.S. publisher go ahead and do it, and that's what we got at Seven Stories Press, who is a quite well-known independent New York City publisher. I mean, it's not a major house, but it's one of the major among the independents.
Yeah.
And definitely a progressive publisher.
Yeah.
So we were
very
pleased with the outcome.
Yeah. Are you going to be bringing books with you when you come out to California?
Yes. I mean, actually, we're having the various shipments are going out. Each place I'm going to, they're going to have a stack to sell. And we hope we have enough. Yeah. Sure.
I was just wondering, because I know I have been just so busy. We're organizing the film festival. And organizing a rally. We're having a rally on Saturday. It's our 7th annual 9/11 Truth March and Rally. Wish you could be there. It'd be nice if you could.
I'd be in Seattle, right?
Okay. You'll be in Seattle, right?
Right.
And I know. And I actually, one reason I chose, put a lot of energy into it was I was hoping Bob Bowman would be at the rally. But he's going to be in Monterey. But we have Richard Gage, who's going to be with us at the rally on Saturday. And then it's just so much work organizing rallies and film festivals, and also just getting the shipments of all the all the DVDs and books and things to have available for the rally and, and the film festival. It's just a challenge.
I appreciate the enormous work involved because I'm a union organizer, so I know how to do. I've been a union president. I've organized rallies and earlier in my life, you know, so I know the huge amount of commitment you're putting into this. It's really great.
Although I must admit, it's hard to juggle everything. So I'm the person who's going to be on the second hour, Jules Edward. He's been working for 3 months on the United for Truth rally in Brussels, which David Ray Griffin endorsed, the maker of Zero, and which is the film we're going to be showing in the evening at the Grand Lake Theater, which was shown in the European Parliament. He's also endorsed the March on Brussels. So he's got, I think, already 400 people lined up or coming from 40 different countries. But I think it's really wonderful that your book, it sounds like it is a very collaborative effort, and trying to pull together a rally with so many people from all across Europe. It's also a huge collaborative effort. That's what this movement is. The subject is so huge that we're just so fortunate that there are people who are doing the academic research, and then there's the artists, and then there's people who make posters, and the people who carry books, and you know, there's just
right,
so many,
right.
So much work involved.
that's right. Yeah, you need a whole spectrum of people doing many different things to make progress. No question about it.
Right, and I must applaud you also. I remember challenging Philip Zelikow at Stanford University when he came here to speak, and I saw you questioning him on the video that's posted on YouTube, and I'm glad you questioned him, although I think he deserves to be challenged more thoroughly.
Yes, he squealed out of there pretty quickly. We got a few questions in, but then he left. But it was kind of an interesting environment. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but in your book, I think there is an update. Brian Sachs, go into a bit more of Zelikow's history? I think Zelikow really does. He could merit almost an entire book himself. To expose who he is and what he did, his role in 9/11 and in the cover-up. Don't you think that's prosecutable?
It's not something I would do. Other things, but I can wish that somebody else would do it, sure.
Well, when you give your talk about your book, what are the points that you... that you feel are the most important that you make in it?
That's actually, I try and pose it in a way which leaves it open to the listener what is most important, because people come to 9/11 from many different directions. For example, some people, I know people who approached me that the single most important thing that astonished them was that there was no defenses for the towers, for the Pentagon. How come the military wasn't involved? I mean, here, this is the most sophisticated military operation in the whole world and world history even, and they couldn't even defend the Pentagon. Almost one hour after the first of the towers were hit. I mean, that's amazing. Okay, and some people are struck by that. Some people move on, follow the money direction. That was the insider trading, which is my specialty, that occurred before 9/11. And others focus on the collapse of the towers. And another approach is the hijackers issue. So it goes in many different directions. So I like to open up all the possibilities and let people decide for themselves which appeals to them the most.
we have a break now. You can tell by the music, but we'll be back with Paul Zaremka in just a few minutes.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Call is out across the land, the impeachment of Bush. For crimes and lies, you'd like to see him kicked out on his push. Friends, you've got good reason. I support you absolutely. But this impeachment season, don't forget your civic duty. Impeach Cheney first.
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm Carol Bia, speaking with Paul Zaremka. And we were just talking about what key points of evidence to help people wake up to 9/11. And I think the hijacker's identity is like one of the major areas that especially the Europeans feel that that's where our focus should be, that that's the most compelling evidence. Do you want to talk about, you did some work on that, didn't you?
Yeah, it wasn't my own chapter, but it's the very first chapter of the book by Jay Kolar. And I said that this is a collective work, but I guess the one thing that the editor really had to do is figure out the order in which the chapters would appear. So it was my choice to have the hijackers come very first. And the reason why I did that is partly because that is absolutely essential that if there were hijackers, and I can talk about that separate question later, but if there were hijackers, we have to know who they were. Okay, I mean what their nationalities were, what so on. The identities of the persons. And the 9/11 Commission it's so ridiculous on that question. This is supposed to be a report, reporting to the world and to the nation about what happened on 9/11, and it gives you no evidence for any of the 19 hijackers. It simply asserts that these 19 individuals did the operation, but never tells you how they know that those individuals did it, nor does it even tell you where to go to find out where those individuals did it. And so what's striking is that if you paid attention to the press, the world press, after 9/11, something like 10 of the hijackers showed up somewhere in the world saying, the alleged hijackers stated somewhere in the world that, hey, you've identified me, I'm still alive, what are you doing that for? It was reported in major publications, reported in the L.A. Times, the BBC, a Saudi newspaper. I mean, I don't remember the full list of all the places that it appeared, but there were, we're not just talking about mix-ups of names. We're talking about people who were identified with a name, spelling either the same or the transliteration being the same, their pictures being the same, and their biography, the thumbnail sketches that were provided about who they were being the same. So, I mean, it's far clearer than just simply the possible confusion of a name or something like that. So you have 10 people in the world who said, I'm alive, after 9/11, who are the same people that the 9/11 Commission reports and the FBI shortly after 9/11 said, or were the alleged hijackers. That's absurd. I mean, it's absurd.
Right.
If you find even one or two people like that, you ought to nail it down completely to find out what you're doing. But to have 10 of them like that is just, and not to confront that evidence. I mean, not to report that BBC said so and so is alive. Not to even mention the fact that that report existed. Not to confront it is a scandal, frankly. But the issues go further than that about the hijackers. one of the evidences they provide is that Atta and one of the other alleged hijackers flew out of Portland, Maine to Boston, and they provide a video of that. And they have the video has the date and the time and so on, what you'd expect on a videotape of a security camera. But the problem with that evidence is that that is not Boston. The plane left from Boston, not from Portland, Oregon. So if they were doing anything, they were doing a connection in flights. But why don't you provide the security cameras in Boston instead of the security camera in Portland, Maine? So it's as simple as that. That's not evidence about who boarded the plane in Boston. They have some, there's a video provided what happened in Dulles Airport. They allege that two of the hijackers went through security cameras in Dulles Airport. But in the Dulles Airport video, there's absolutely no dating. So you don't even know when the video was taken. There's no identification of the tape itself. It's just a picture. And furthermore, in the beginning of the picture of the individuals, they show cars arriving in Dulles Airport. And the cars that are arriving aren't shadowed very deep. And there was this, it's like it was like 11 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The shadows are not stark. I mean, they're not long shadows. But, in fact, those people would have arrived at the airport something like a half hour or no later than an hour after sunrise. So there would have been long shadows. So the pictures provided in Dulles' video don't correspond to the time of day that the hijackers would have arrived at the airport. So that's not evidence either. I mean, it's simply not evidence. And then there's other major problems that some of the hijackers had. For example, one of them was very clearly a double. And this is one of the things we get out of the soft cover edition of the book that's not in the hard covers. We have pictures of Mr. Jara, who was the alleged pilot of the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. And so what we do is Jay Kolar, found like 9 different pictures or 8 different pictures of this individual, 7 out of the 8 provided by official government sources, you know, like a passport picture, like a student ID, a visa application, and checked whether the same individual was being shown in all those pictures. And there's actually 3 different individuals that you can identify in those 9 pictures. In other words, Zara had a double. Mm-hmm. A double means somebody who was posing as him but wasn't him. Mm-hmm. So there's a real Jara who was born, by the way, in Lebanon, was actually raised in an Islamic family, but went to a Catholic church. I mean, not church, Catholic school in Lebanon. So he was educated in a Christian environment, and nobody reports that he was ever had any fundamentalism about any religion. I mean, he was a rather a religious kind of guy, a fun-loving kind of guy. Nothing that would ever indicate that he was the kind of person who would be the pilot of the plane, United Airlines 93 over Pennsylvania. But even aside from that, I mean, the pictures that are shown of him show 2 or 3 different individuals, which shows that the setup has occurred. Now, it's possible he was on the plane and that they were just using the fact that he was on the plane they needed an Arab name, so they pulled him up and claimed that he was the alleged pilot. And even the people, I mean, the Flight 93 had the most people who were supposedly talking on cell phones are mostly by air. Well, that's another whole issue, by the way, is air phones on Flight 93. And these people didn't identify Jara as getting into the cabin. In fact, they actually refer to 3 alleged hijackers, not the 4. I mean, it's kind of confused discussion, but I just want to indicate that the 9/11 Commission report just listed hijackers and expected you to take their word for it. That's all it's about. There's no evidence there. Nothing you'd do in a courtroom.
Well, thank you. We're going to be back with Paul in just a few minutes after these messages.
Great host, great topics, free speech at its best. This is We the People Radio Network.
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance.
Mr. President, I wish to document.
Okay, let's see. Okay. So I'm speaking with Paul Zaremka, who's the author of The Hidden History of 9/11. And Paul, you did some original research too, looking into the put options. Do you want to share what you found, that piece of it?
Yes, it's going to take me a little bit of concentration here to describe put options, because many people aren't really familiar with how the stock market works, and I'm an economist, so I guess I know. if you are involved in the financial markets and you have some information about a company that nobody else knows or almost nobody else knows, and you take advantage of that knowledge, then you're engaging in insider trading. In other words, you're engaged in trading about with knowledge that other people don't have, and presumably you could make a lot of profit from that insider knowledge. There's three ways to use insider knowledge. One way is simply if you own a stock and you know the stock is going to go up big or down big, you can either buy it if it's going to go up big or sell it if it's going to go down. But for a situation like 9/11, when you have American Airlines and United Airlines going into two different towers and crashing possibly into the Pennsylvania and to Pennsylvania and to United Airlines Flight 93 crashing into the state of Pennsylvania, you probably don't already own the stock, so you have two other options. One is to what they call short sell the stock. That means you sell the stock today in the anticipation that the price will go down, and then you buy the stock back later in order to be able to, quote, cover the position of the stock you sold short. How do you sell short? You sell short by having a brokerage firm basically loaning you the stock, and you have to return the stock. So selling short is sell the stock short and cover the position by giving the firm the stock back by buying it later. And if the price has gone down, you can make a lot of profit. So that's short selling. However, on 9/11, the most discussed options was something called put options. And put options are an opportunity to sell a stock at today's price and buy it back at a much lower price sometime in the future. But it's always a specified future. It might be 45 days. It might be 90 days. I mean, it just depends. It's called the strike price is the price that you would be able to sell it at, let's say, within the next 45 days. But you don't have to. So usually the cost of a put option isn't very large. I mean, it might cost you, let's say, $1 to have the option to sell a stock 45 days from now at a price, let's say, of $30. It might even be cheaper than that. It might be more expensive. I mean, I don't really want to discuss that particular issue.
I've bought puts and call options most of my life, so I already know this stuff. So,
great.
For other people.
But other people don't.
Understand.
Right.
I think it's pretty clear. It's foreknowledge and it's financial instruments.
Yes. Right. So then the question becomes, how much was taking place? And and what was happening right after 9/11 is that the major mainstream press was reporting dramatic levels of put options than American Airlines, United Airlines before 9/11. We're talking numbers like claimed to be like 900 times the usual level. I think that the reason why there were such dramatic reports is not only the fact that the evidence is there, but also people, sort of ordinary financial people, reporting because they thought that all you had to do was follow the money and you'd get to bin Laden. I mean, I think they thought that we could get to bin Laden that way. And basically, so they were kind of sucking the investigators into that direction. But suddenly, all that investigation just fell into silence, and we heard nothing more. However, there was a major study done by Professor Potifman in the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, who published an article in the Journal of Business, and that's a very reputable, normal business journal, academic journal, peer-reviewed and everything else. He had access to confidential data that the rest of us can't get. I think what was happening is the Chicago Board of Trade wanted to investigate whether, in fact, it is possible to identify insider trading or not, and he was using the 9/11 situation to see if models could be developed. So they gave him access to data of specific names of companies and specific trades that took place, and he used that to do an intensive investigation of what happened in the days before 9/11. And the bottom line is that he found out with like a 99% probability that there was insider trading before 9/11. Now, part of the problem
was... Has he revealed who did it or who did the trading?
No, he wouldn't know that. I mean, that wouldn't be his... When I said that he had confidential information, what he has confidential information on the trades, but not who did the trades.
Okay.
So then that raises the question, well, could you identify those people? And yes, it's not difficult at all. I mean, the government always is able to trace where transactions took place. And people who are in the business say so. I mean, it's not a secret that they could identify it. So what does the 9/11 Commission report do? It skirts over this problem with this report in the mainstream press by simply saying one sentence and then having a relatively long footnote basically describing that this is all nonsense, there was nothing particularly unusual, or if it was unusual, it's certainly not anybody who was identified with Al-Qaeda,
right.
Which is a circular argument, actually, because if you're trying to investigate who did it, you don't exclude anybody from doing it until you find out where it goes to.
Right.
And then they went ahead I'm talking still about the 9/11 Commission. They went ahead and made a couple of comments about the trades that took place. One of them they claimed was 2,000 stock trades, I mean, put options that took place a couple of days before 9/11, and they said that was done by one person who was also doing some other, or at least one firm that was also doing some other transactions. But they went on to say that person could in no way be identified with Al-Qaeda. Well, I mean, how do I know that? I mean, first of all, who says Al-Qaeda did 9/11? You know, so...
Yeah,
they assumed their conclusion before they. It's the same thing that they did with the hijackers. I mean, they assumed the hijackers are Al-Qaeda, and that they were the people that carried out the whole operation. The same thing is true with the insider trading investigation.
Yeah,
and then they also looked at they claimed that another one of the trades was motivated by a fax being sent by a financial newspaper, which said that one of those airlines was in trouble, and therefore one should buy put options on that stock. But there's lots of financial newspapers and bulletins going out all the time, and they don't even indicate that they even asked the people who were on the subscribers list whether they in fact engaged in the trade, nor did they even identify who the bulletin was. I mean, maybe it doesn't even exist, or if it exists, nobody engaged in any of the transactions that was being suggested. So it's not credible. It's simply not credible.
Yeah. That I didn't find Zelikow at all compelling when I heard him. I thought he was just lying through his teeth. I was so outraged when I heard him speak. And I think that's what the whole tone of the book is just one enormous lie. And it looks like we have a break now, but we'll be back with Paul Zaremka in just a few minutes. Pushing War, Organizing Resistance. I'm Carol Brier, and I'm speaking with Paul Zaremka, who is the author of The Hidden History of 9/11. And, Paul, we have a caller from Minnesota. Gail, did you have something that you wanted to say?
Actually, I was just calling to let you know that I'm having a really hard time. I have three computers here, and your broadcast is very scratchy tonight for some reason. I'm having trouble hearing you. I didn't know if that's the common problem or not, but I just wanted to let someone know.
Okay. I know it was bad at the beginning, but it's still really bad right now?
Yeah, it is. I pulled it up on three different computers. I took my computer apart because at first I thought it must be my computer.
Oh, dear. Gosh. Well, I don't know what to do because I'm doing this from California with Skype, and then there's the guys in Texas who have all the equipment, and Paul's on a phone in
Buffalo.
The East Coast. Right. Buffalo, yeah. And so we're doing the best that we can, but
God bless you, and you have a great program, I didn't think I'd be on the air. I thought I'd be letting someone in technical support know, so I apologize.
Okay. Well, thanks for letting us know, and I hope we can overcome our technological challenges here.
Yep, Gail. You have a great show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I thought she was calling just to let us know what the situation actually was in Minnesota, because I know that part of the problem of 9/11 is that it has been used to relabel any challenges to the government as terrorist dissent. And there's a tremendous amount of repression going on in Minneapolis right now, preemptive terrorism against protesters. And
exactly.
I think in your book, too, the whole myth of Al-Qaeda as being this enemy that justifies all sorts of military intervention. Do you want to talk about some of the work that Ahmed has done on this? And I haven't read McGregor's chapter on Machiavellian state terrorism.
Yes, Nafez Ahmed actually was one of the first writers about 9/11. He wrote books, for example, The War on Freedom and The War on Terror, Behind the War on Terror. But what his contribution here is to focus specifically on the interconnection, and this is now important, the interconnection between individuals who they claim to be al-Qaeda and Western intelligence agencies. Not in the sense of these individuals being tracked by Western intelligence, but rather being an integral part of Western intelligence. I don't mean just American. I mean more broadly Western intelligence. So what his basic conclusion is there's no meaningful separation between what is called as al-Qaeda and Western intelligence. So, I mean, if you follow that along, it basically says if you hear on the radio that al-Qaeda did this or did that, you can just simply substitute the word Western intelligence did this or did that, okay? Or if you want to make it more concrete, the American CIA or something like that did this or did that. And that's quite dramatic, to say the least.
Yeah, well, but I can't help agreeing with him. I know Nafez pretty well, actually.
Right.
And I think that's what actually got me working on this issue is Michelle Chasudowski has also done some really good work in this regard. And basically the financial links, just the head of Pakistani intelligence alone meeting with top U.S. government officials, it sort of exposes the hand of Western intelligence all over the so-called al-Qaeda.
Yes.
We also have a caller from California. Rick, did you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I have my question was, with all this information, you know, I want to thank you guys for even putting this out, first of all, because, you know, not a lot of people know this, then obviously. But my question would be, for the average day person, what could we do in order to, besides spread the message and let other people know what's really going on, what else do you think would you suggest that you would do if, you know, you were hearing this for the first time?
That's a good question. Paul, do you want to respond to that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, first of all, you're much more involved with organizing around 9/11 than I am, so you're probably in a better position to answer it. But I do want to say that the intellectual work is important. I mean, one shouldn't jump too fast. I mean, you can jump as fast as you want, but one should know what one is doing. The world is pretty complicated out there. And even in the 9/11 movement, there's a lot of differences. So it's very worthwhile to do your homework first. You want to add something, Carol?
Well, I just want to add that I became an activist when I went to the library and I found all these books and discovered what our CIA and our intelligence agencies were up to. And I think that 9/11 is probably the most dramatic example of the malfeasance of intelligence agencies pulling off something like this, and that it is, in some ways, one chance to actually wake up the American people as to what their government is doing and how harmful it is, not just here, but throughout the world. So in order to rein in our government and to change these policies, which I find so horrendous, that's how I became an activist. And I know for me, before I became an activist, I had done publicity, and I thought the most important thing was getting the information out to people so that they could do something, and then learning how to organize. And I would recommend to you, Rick, and to anyone else, there's a great book, Doing Democracy, which maps out how social movements work and how to be an effective activist and how to recognize the stages movements go through. But I think when people are first confronted with this information, it can be overwhelming, and it can shake up people's worldviews. And sometimes people need to go through months of adjustment before they feel comfortable going to doing something about or taking action. It depends on the individual, though. Some people, you know, have been raised with activist families, and they can go out and start doing things right away. I grew up in a Republican family, so it took a little bit of time for me to become active. But you know, it's part of the learning and growing process. But I do think that for the movement, one of the most important things is to help people understand what state-sponsored terrorism is, how it works, and that the movement is well beyond the United States, because this affects people all over the world, and they're trying to do research, expose state-sponsored terrorism in their countries, and there is a global movement now, and it's good for all of us to know that, you know, we're in this with all of humanity. It's not just Americans. It's not just an American problem or a British problem. I hope that
helps. That's definitely correct. And in fact, one of the previous state-sponsored terrorist operations was Operation Galateo, which was in many countries in Europe, particularly in Italy, and there's been a lot of exposure of those operations. Europeans generally have more, I think probably more easily understand that their own state could do a terrorist act, perhaps because of their own world history, differing from the United States. So it's maybe easier for Europeans to move forward than for Americans. But I'm not sure of that. I mean, I was just sort of speculating.
Well, we'll probably find out in the next hour from Jules, who's been organizing in Europe. But I think we have a lot to learn from one another. And sometimes it's good to be to have a little bit of distance. I think one reason it's easier for me to act is I wasn't as traumatized as the people in New York. I think some people are really, the whole purpose of terrorism is to frighten people and
to shut down
their rational thinking process. So if you have a bit more distance, it's easier to see what's going on than if you're, you know, if you're shattered emotionally.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much, Paul and Rick, for the call.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Okay, great. I'll be there. Yep, see you next week. Okay.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks very much.
Thank you.